Let's get started. Okay, so our seminar this morning is on creating a culture of critical thinking in the classroom. Creating a culture of critical thinking in the classroom. And you know, I'm not really sure at what age this can really begin. I don't know. First grade teachers would have to tell me, second grade teachers. So let's just talk about this. Is this biblical? Do we want to create critical thinking in the classroom? Take your Bibles, please, and turn to 1 Peter. If you have it with you, if not, I'll just read you the verse. You know this verse, but I just want to remind you of it. And let's see if we can tie the two together to creating a culture of critical thinking in the classroom. Creating a culture of critical thinking in the classroom. 1 Peter chapter number 3, and the verse, of course, is verse 15. 1 Peter chapter number 3, verse 15. Sanctify the Lord your God in your hearts. Okay, I got that. And, conjunction, be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason of the hope that is in you. Obviously, my focus is on what word?
An answer.
Got to be able to give an answer. I'm charged by the Word of God to give an answer. Luke describes Paul as going in amongst the heathen and reasoning. Reasoning. He reasoned with them. Let's talk about that word reasoning. What do you think I'm supposed to take away from the idea of reasoning? Give me some feedback. What do you think is being described there with the word reasoned? He reasoned with them. Jackie.
Isaiah chapter 1 verse 18 says, come let us reason together, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. And it gives the idea of us actually having a logical, factual-based conversation. It's not an emotionalism. It's tied to a concrete concepts that are absolutely, should be apparent to anybody within the conversational realm.
Okay, another one. Nate?
Anticipating the opposition, the opposing side, and answering, being prepared to answer that.
James?
It's the why we believe what we believe.
It's the why we believe what we believe. The word answer in our text is the Greek word that we get what from?
Apologetics.
All right. Apologetics. Sometimes we think about apologetics as a separate class I take when I'm at college. I'm going to take apologetics. Is that how I should think about apologetics? How should I think about apologetics then? How should I think about apologetics?
It's a responsibility of every believer.
Every believer. So, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's incorporated into every facet of life. What you believe and why you believe it touches every choice you make.
How do we measure our success? How do we normally, as an institution, especially as in high school, but as an academy, how do we measure our success? What are we always looking at and going, I wish that, or we talked about it yesterday, our graduates. Mm-hmm. We're looking
SAT
at our
graduates.
Okay, SAT scores. What else? So, what do we really look at?
We want to see them go and live full Christian lives. We want to see them stay in the church. We want to see them going and serving in the ministry.
Don't we just feel so defeated when we hear about a graduate that goes into the world? Mm-hmm. We literally measure our success by serving the Lord. Whether that's college, whether that's the army. We look at, what are they listening to? What music are they listening to? What is their worldview? Where did they go to college? Are they still married? Did they get married? Are they living together in sin? These are all ways that we look at how effective we were as an institution. It's not much different than how we do as parents. You want your boy to go to college, complete it, marry someone? You don't want him to cohabitate? It would infuriate you if he was cohabitating? It would cause you to question your entire existence as parents if he departed from the faith? He would say, where did we fail? He would. All of us that have either, like me, a 17-year-old, or some of you either a high school graduate and both, you're... So, critical thinking. Critical thinking. What when you hear the word critical, does it contain positive connotations or negative connotations? The word critical.
Negative.
What?
Negative.
Negative usually.
Critical just alone, I'd say negative. But critical thinking is positive.
But the very word critical. The very word critical.
In our circles, though, textual criticism has gotten a bad rap. And so people automatically, when we think critical thinking, we think that that's tearing down something. Where in actuality, it could be actually, it helps build up if it's done the right way.
All right, so unpack textual criticism just to give us a little context there.
Well, it's when scholars take a text and they try to decide what should be in the text and what should not be in the text, and that's what the King James translators would have done. They would have practiced textual criticism, and when they translate new Bibles, they do textual criticism. What should be here, what shouldn't be here?
I got multiple manuscripts that I'm looking at, right? And I'm trying to figure out which one best represents what Paul wrote. And they look like this, and they're slightly variants, and we're being critical. Being critical.
Well, it's the same like in a math problem. You always tear it down. You critically think, what you got to tear the problem down. So the basis, you see everything. You can't just look at the whole. You got to tear the problem down, look at what you're looking at, where do you want to go with that problem.
There's like what Joey's saying is, you know, you look at the guys like the Augustine and the guys that were looking at what the canon was, they broke it down, but for key signs of apostleship, writing, connection, and everything else. And then here in our modern day, they've taken a very different approach in trying to discredit it, and that's kind of the bandwagon we jumped on. And we start thinking of critical thinking is, we're going to tear something apart to be harsh with it so we don't have to be accountable to it, when we should actually be taking the earlier approach. Let's break it down and find out why we believe it, so it concretes us to move forward and build a better product. So we critically think about our classroom or our concepts. We break down our classroom to its ultimate fundamental level and say, okay, these are the things that are right. This is what I'm going to build upon to get a product that is a child who's still serving God once they leave our institution.
All right, let's talk to parents for just a minute. Three boys and a girl. Four girls. Two boys and a girl. Right? Who else? Who else has got multiple children? Two girls. Anybody else? Yeah, boy and a girl. Okay. That's about it. Yeah, but so small. Think about your three boys. Think about your four girls. Do some of them have more of a bent towards critical thinking than others?
Yes.
Right. Think about you. Don't say any names because we're recording this, but just kind of describe the child and talk about that for just a moment, Kevin.
Okay. He labors if he does a paper, if he does any like for Bible class or anything like that. He labors over it and he picks it apart. He thinks through every detail. He's looking for the sources to back up what he's saying. He just labors over it, and even comes to conversations when somebody just makes a statement, and he's picking the statement apart. Well, it couldn't be this because it's just about everything he does is critical thinking.
All right, your four girls. Talk to us about the one that has bent most towards that.
She questions everything. She'll even take the devil's advocate sometimes. But she's thinking.
Right, she's thinking.
She's thinking through the problem. Or, Dad, why do you do what you do?
Right.
Why is this set?
I want to unpack that just a little bit because you said it, Jeff. I want to talk about this idea of thinking. Thinking. All right, if you ask me what the capital of Virginia is, ask me.
What is the capital of Virginia?
And I say, Richmond. Is that thinking?
No.
It's rote.
Now, how well does that help me for the future? Let's talk about that. How well does that help me for the future?
Depends on your what your future is at the end of the day.
I want to focus it on 1 Peter chapter number 3 and my responsibility to give an answer for the hope that lies within me.
Well, it gives you a knowledge base, something to build off of.
Okay, a knowledge base. All right, okay, I'm good with that. Mm-hmm. But what after that? Then what? Like, we can go to Jeff. Let's go back up there with math. I'm sure, Jeff, that you've encountered students that can just rattle off the combinations, the division, the math, and all that. But when you need them to unpack layers and layers and layers and take all that foundation to get to the solution, it becomes incredibly difficult for them. Yes. And then you probably have others who can unpack stuff but make mathematical errors in the process of getting the solution, but they can walk you through how the solution should be derived. Is that fair?
In several ways. They can do it several ways, but get to the same solution. That's exactly right.
But they're thinkers. Right. And then there's others that are just incredible with spelling, incredible with things that it's just, this is the right answer. This is I just need to know the right answer. So I'm not here to put down learning the right answer. That's not what I'm asking you guys to think about. What am I wanting us to push towards?
Teaching them to think and know why they believe what they believe.
Yeah, I really want us to work harder on teaching them to think. To think. I've talked to graduates. I've talked to others. I didn't learn to think until I went to college. What do you think they're saying when they say something like that, Megan? When a student says, I didn't learn to think until I went to college, what are they trying to communicate there?
All they learned is what a fact was, the answer to a question. But when they come in and they get to college and they face these people that come up and ask them a question, or a professor that asked them their actual opinion on this, or why is this the answer, or why was that, why did Richmond ever become the capital of Virginia, or why did these different things, they don't have any of that extra knowledge to explain through the whole situation. They just knew the answer to the question they were asked.
So what I'm asking you guys to begin to do at first grade and second grade and third grade and fifth grade and sixth grade and into the high schools is I'm asking you to begin to look at lessons that you deliver and say, how can I begin to incorporate critical thinking into this lesson? How can I begin to incorporate critical thinking? So we're not saying changing the lesson. That's not what we're saying. We're saying I'm looking at this lesson, and I have a responsibility to not only teach children information, but I need to help them learn how to think. They've got to be critical thinkers. And I think sometimes teachers, me, all of us included, we are guilty of the critical thinkers. We just want to shut them up. Mm-hmm. Yes. Because we need to move through the curriculum. And moving through the curriculum is equated to rote memorization. Critical thinkers are not interested in rote memorization.
Mm-hmm. No. They want to know why. Why is this important? Why are we doing this?
Yeah. And we can almost create a culture where we're just looking for compliancy. And we reward compliance. Just compliant. Just get along, go along. Do you understand what I mean? Am I making sense? Can you guys connect with what I'm saying? Can you relate that to anything that you've had? Can someone share a thought that you have with what I'm talking about with this? Yeah.
I had a little boy in my class last year that, I mean, he was phenomenally intelligent. I remember telling the class that history began with the creation of man and that there was no such thing as the word prehistoric. And he said, well, he raised his hand and he said, well, Ms. Smith, what about the things God created before man? Are they prehistoric then?
Very good.
Okay, I also told him another instance that there's no oxygen in space and that for a fire to burn, you have to have oxygen. He said, how does the sun burn? Mm-hmm. You know, just, yes, over and over again. And I mean, I've had a few students like that, but he was far and above the best one I've ever had.
Right.
And we tried to channel that and think of ways, but...
What we want to do at Berean Baptist Academy is we want to create a culture, okay, a culture to where that kind of questioning is rewarded, not suppressed. Because we think that if we can just fill the mind with enough information, they'll become a disciple of Christ and they'll be fine. Not true at all. In many cases, all we're putting off is the inevitable. They just graduate and then they become agnostic. They graduate and then they become an atheist. They graduate and then they start exploring the enemy because we kept the enemy away from them. Do you know what I mean by the enemy? The opposing view. The view that has to be grappled with. The view that has to be dealt with. I'm not going to come to a firm solution on this until I determine for sure that this is not acceptable. If you keep this in isolation and you don't tell me about this, then I'm not really as firm in this as I think. Because there's this other opposing thing out here that I need to grapple with a little bit. Now, every child is different. We've already identified that. Some have a bent towards just, okay, I got it, you know, boom. There's others that really need to get over here and explore this and deal with this. So do we want them to begin to do that when they graduate? And then what is their conclusion about the education they received at the academy?
It's insufficient.
That's right. Say that again, please.
Insufficient.
Right. Jackie.
And I read a book recently called The World is Flat, and it talks about the globalization of technology and the wealth of information that's interconnected to everything. And they got to talking about Georgia Tech, which is one of the finest engineering schools in our nation. They're now turning down guys that have 4.0, 4-point plus GPAs that haven't taken fine arts. Because though they know they can do all the scientific mathematical facts, they have no creativity. Therefore, they're not the critical thinkers that can come up with the solutions to the emerging problems that we're facing in the world. And I think that's indicative to us as secondary educators, elementary educators. If we want our students to go to those kind of schools, then we have to prepare them to go to those schools. And if the schools of higher ed are starting to look for that balance between the rote and the creative thinking, the critical thinking, then it's imperative that we do what we're doing right now.
All right, let's go to this. Who?
What?
What?
Why?
Where?
Where?
Why?
How?
When?
How?
And how? Okay, we all got this. We all have it. All right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Now, as educators, which ones are the easiest to test and which ones are the hardest to test?
What is easy?
The first four are the easy test.
Sure. This is easy. That's why we have a bent towards this. That's exactly why we have a bent towards this. It's either right or wrong. 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 It's easy to test. It's easy to grade. It's not subjective at all. You know? Who was the first president of the United States? When was he the first president of the United States? Those are all easy questions. Yes or no?
Yes.
So let's just go that way, man. It's either right or it's wrong. And those that get it right are rewarded. Those who get it wrong are not. And all of a sudden, being an A student means that I am able to memorize information and on test day, regurgitate it. Mm-hmm. And I'm an A student. Does that prepare me for life? Does it?
Not completely.
No. And even in the day and age we're living in, let's just think about this. This information here, the who, what, when, why, in the day and age that I'm receiving it, I can find the who, what, and why anytime I want, 24 hours a day on Google.
That's right.
Yeah. In a millisecond. Yeah. I mean, why am I going to commit that to memory? Honestly. I mean, that's a struggle. What? I don't need to know that. I can find that date right now. When was, and I just type it in there. And a second later, Google will have it for me. And if I have Siri on my iPhone, I don't even type it. I can just ask Siri the question, and it'll answer it for me. But you know what Siri can't answer?
Why?
That's what I can't answer right here. Would you turn over to Romans 13:1? You're already familiar with this verse, but I just want to give you an example of critical thinking. Kevin, read it, please.
Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God.
Okay, so I'm teaching a history lesson. I'm in fifth grade, and I'm teaching a history lesson. All right, you got two fifth grade teachers. And I'm teaching a lesson, and we're talking about the colonial overthrow of the British government. Okay? Is that a reasonable history level at fifth grade? Probably fourth grade also?
Yes, sir.
Okay? So here's what I want to know. Were the colonists who we hold up as Puritans and separatists and people worthy of emulation, were they sinning when they overthrew the British government?
You want us to answer?
Let's look at Romans 13:1. What's it say? Okay, was the King of England a higher power?
Yes.
Ordained by God?
Yes. Not when he declared war against the colonies and removed them from...
He wasn't a higher power at that point? Is there an exception clause at the verse?
That's why the Founding Fathers were so careful in the Declaration of Independence to write a document virtually crediting the Acts 4 kind of principle, where it says where you cross the line and violated godly principles, we are required by our God to overthrow you.
Yes.
And that goes back to Peter and John saying we ought to obey God rather than man.
What I'm asking you to do in the objective of creating a culture of critical thinking is I want you as a teacher to start an argument in your class. Mm-hmm. And I want you to step back and let the argument go. I just want you to watch the argument, and I just want you to channel the argument, and I don't want you to give them a right answer. Because we've already seen right now that we don't have a right answer even in this room right here.
I was going to say, my best teacher, and he won Teacher of the Year in the United States, was a Christian, and he knew that I was a Christian as well, and a public school, and he let me and another student duel out our viewpoints in the middle of a history class and let everyone else watch. And that, me being not very good at defending myself, it taught me so much on how we need to be on our toes at all times. And I will never, ever forget him for that.
You know, now this means that you're going to have to look at how you're teaching. It means you're going to be looking at your lessons. You're going to be looking for how can I incorporate critical thinking in this lesson. You're going to come up with a discussion question that you know is going to be controversial. You're not going to provide an answer. And then you as a teacher, you're going to be real careful to watch the students that won't ever talk. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to shut down the students that just want to dominate the conversation. You've got to be a moderator. You follow what I'm saying, teachers? Because you got three or four in your class that they'll go with it. You got others that don't want to put their head down on the desk. So you're there not to just deal with the three that you've got to work hard at engaging so-and-so that doesn't even know how to think about these things. That one is running down the road with it. I see where you're going. And the other one is doesn't even have any clue why we even have this conversation. See the difference? And you have to be the one that does that. We don't want to create a culture to where the teacher has the right answer. No, we want a culture to where they think through it. So this means that this and this is very important. It's critically important. Here's another one. How about this one? The Old Testament is replete with examples of God deceiving people. Using someone to deceive someone. So why is it wrong for us to deceive people? What if it's justifiable?
It depends if it's to sin or not to sin.
See, we have two choices in the academy. We can take these type of things and bury them as deep as we can so that they have to discover them later on, or we can bring them up to the forefront and say, let's deal with this. Now, do you want your students to remember you for... Or, no, this is not the first time I've heard about this. My freshman year of college is not the first time I heard about this. My sophomore year of college is not the first time I heard about this. Isaiah 46, I believe, the King James says that God creates evil. What? Wrap your brain around that for a couple minutes. God creates evil? Mm-hmm. Is that the right word? Hmm.
It's an evil spirit to Saul.
Right. So where did evil come from?
Well, it says, well, there is no law, there is no sin. In the mere fact that he created a boundary, he set the conditions for what sin is by the exceeding of that boundary.
Sure did.
So that he created evil.
Or the potential for evil.
Or potential for evil, yeah.
See, we don't want to have a culture in our church teachers to where, this just learn this. Just learn this and graduate. Just learn this and graduate. No. So in math, yes, that's the right answer. How many different ways can you come up with that answer? How many different ways can you come to that solution? See, I can't answer for every one of you. That's impossible. You have a responsibility to figuring out, this is what I teach. Now, how can I incorporate critical thinking? For example, every textbook that we have is written by a publisher, a Christian, an author, a person. All right, what does that person or team of writers bring with them to their writing? Someone tell me.
Their philosophy.
Their philosophy.
Presuppositions.
Their presuppositions.
Sinful nature.
Their sinful nature. So, is it wrong for us to criticize the textbook? Is it wrong for us to criticize the textbook?
No.
Could we use the textbook as a means of teaching critical thinking? Yes or no?
Yes. Yes.
But we almost get this idea in Christianity that we don't want to create questioning Christians. Just accept it. We've got to teach them that this is the only infallible book that we have, and everything else comes with presuppositions. Everything else comes with bias. Everything else comes with a human wrote this. Mm-hmm. Now, all our Abeka textbooks, our Bob Jones textbooks, are going to come from a very what worldview?
Astrological.
Yeah. So if we don't incorporate the opposing argument in the textbook, they're not going to get a well-rounded education, folks. Mm. They're not. They're not going to get a well-rounded. Everyone doesn't agree with this. You need to know that everyone doesn't agree with this. That this is one perspective. Now, what do you think the opposing perspective would be? And then let the conversation go.
It's a lot of fun in a math class because I don't often get to use science in math because students think those are two separate subjects. But they're not. And when the question in a Saxon textbook says, when the earth was created 4.5 billion years ago, and I just pause and I listen to the student's reaction to that comment. And I feel like I'm doing a good job when they, as opposed to, yeah, that's fine. Because that's a critical thinking. Did they realize that I just said something that was false in a textbook?
Potentially false, right? Yeah. We want our, see, you're doing in high school novel-based, right? So we're reading through novels and we're learning English through reading through novels, right? And you're starting that in ninth grade?
Correct.
Okay. Well, if you, fifth grade teachers, sixth grade teachers, if you haven't been teaching them how to be critical of the textbook, they jump into that freshman class, they have no idea. This is, okay, let's ask it this way. What's the difference between a book report and a book review? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Book reports don't teach me how to be critical thinking. It's a good foundation, right? It's a good foundation. It's read it, information, comprehend it, summarize it, get it grammatically correct, make sure it's organized, present a nice product. It's a foundation. Mm-hmm. Everyone agree with that? It's a foundation. But the next step is what? Evaluate it. Evaluate it. That's what I appreciated most about my Liberty education. There were lots of things that I could criticize. But the thing I appreciated most about my Liberty education is that they could say, review this book. And I could say that that was the worst book ever written. Theologically, it's upside down. I have no idea why you even have it in the curriculum. I would not encourage anyone ever to buy it again. And as long as I had my spelling right, my grammar was right, and I proved my point, I get an A. Mm-hmm. I get an A. I didn't have to comply with the box in order to get an A. I had the freedom to say, that's absurd. I have no idea how anyone could take that position. And as long as I presented a strong argument, I was good. I was good. That's exactly the culture we want to create here. Wouldn't you rather know that a student is struggling with the existence of God in school here than for them to keep that suppressed the entire 4 years? And then it comes out of the closet when they graduate. Wouldn't you rather know that they can say here under the umbrella of a loving Christian community that I'm not even sure there's a God, and that we don't go like you have a big zit growing out of your nose and no one wants to tell you to pop it? Because you know students can be incredibly compliant. They can keep it in the closet. Now, what's your feedback to that? Talk to me. Ask me some questions about that. What does that conjure up in your mind?
I think that, and as an parent point of view too, that we become guilty of not letting them question because that's rebellion. You don't question authority. And so I think that's one cloudy area where you can try to teach them how you can ask questions without being disrespectful. And I think because people think you don't question authority, then they go up and wrote, do everything like everyone else did, and they really don't know what they believe and why they believe what they believe. And it doesn't stick, I don't think.
I think it's very, it's an incredible sign of maturation to be able to have respect for authority and still be able to be critical.
One thing I appreciate, Raina has taught Evelyn, because Evelyn thinks like that, is that she must first say yes, ma'am, and after she says yes, ma'am, and obeys, then she can say, nah, mommy, will you please tell me why? Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful that she's figured that out. You know, don't just say, you know, don't question, but be respectful and then ask for the explanation.
I just think, suppose C.S. Lewis had never been taught to question what people taught him. I mean, we would be without one of the greatest apologists of all time. You know, Martin Luther, same thing. He had never said, okay, well, I'm going to critically take this apart. What does the Bible really say? If you follow through all of its ramifications, what does Christianity really do? I mean, I think maybe one of the reasons we don't have such great Christian apologetics right now is because we are trying to force students into this who, what, where, when memorization, and then expecting them to, you know, just follow blindly instead of asking those, you know, all important questions of, you know, why is this rule here? You know, how is this important in my life right now? Prove it to me, Mrs. Hoff.
Yeah, I'm going to answer that, and then I'll go to you, Joey. 2 years ago in my sophomore class, or 3 years ago, or 4 years ago, that way no one have a clue, I had a student that was really questioning. And I almost wanted to give him demerits because it was borderline disrespectful. But I had to realize that his passion towards wanting to know the answer was not disrespect. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It was hard. You know, because I could sense the hostility. But the hostility wasn't directed to me personally. The hostility was directed towards, I need to know how there could be a God in this world and they're still suffering. Mm-hmm. Now, I can say that question in such a way that you think that I'm mad at you for that question. That, you know, that I'm disrespectful and you're, as the teacher, ready to shut me down and get me compliant again. Or I can realize that the venom, the passion, is not rebellion. It is, I'm really upset about this. I don't understand. Joey.
I think one of the reasons we struggle with this is because we're afraid. At PCC, they have a whole room where they keep opposing viewpoints that they don't want us to learn about because they're afraid, I think, of what we're going to read and that we might actually agree with it. And so I think we have to be willing to put our fear aside, trust in the sovereignty of God, that it's His work to do it in the child's heart, and let them read a book that we might think, well, you know, when I picked up God's Problems by Bart Ehrman, I was afraid to read the book, but I had the same question he had, so I had to try to answer his question. And if it's truth, then at the end, that we know the truth is going to win, and that's what we have to trust in. We can't be afraid. We have to put our fear aside of what they're going to find out.
Anyone else? Deb.
I agree with what Joey just said because I was a questioning child and often was labeled rebellious and got in trouble for asking those questions. And finally, I rebelled quite a bit because I just thought they couldn't answer it. I thought they were stupid. Mm-hmm. And so I just shut down and went a different direction. And I think a lot of that could have been avoided just if people had let me ask the questions I needed to have answered. And if they didn't know, just say, I don't know, and I'll try to find the answer.
So what I'm asking you to do is I'm asking you to look at your Abecta test. I'm asking you to look at your Bob Jones test. I'm asking you to look at those tests and then determine, does it have any critical thinking incorporated? If the answer is no, then add an additional page. Mm-hmm. Think about how you could incorporate. I'm not saying that we eliminate this. We need to learn this. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that not only did I learn this, I learned why, I learned how, or I had to grapple through something in this. The new SATs have what portion on it now that's new?
Written.
A written portion. And how can we prepare our students to do well in that portion of the test? How can we?
Write essays.
Which we don't want to do. Why not?
It's hard to grade.
Absolutely. It takes forever to grade.
It's a lot of work to teach the kids to be able to do that. It's a lot easier to give them a multiple choice test since they answer these questions than they give them 15 questions where they have to write 2 paragraphs about every question.
I promise you, if you want to impress parents as an educator, you get your child coming home talking about how we grappled through this question in class, and the parent said, I hadn't even thought of that. Mm-hmm. You're going to blow them away.
I'll give you an example. Last year with the juniors, we brought in extra material, and we were discussing the idea between North and South over the Civil War and why it was fought, and the common perception that the South fought for states' rights. But then we read a speech from Jefferson Davis that it was a clear indicator in his mind it was a slavery issue and the right to own a human. And he quoted Bible verses where the Bible lends to the possibility that slavery was endorsed. But in the speech, he also let them know as leadership that they needed to communicate to the general populace that it's about states' rights. So there was a duplicity in the states' rights. At the lowest level of the enlisted soldier, they thought they were fighting for states' rights, but the plantation elite was actually had a different agenda in it. But we also weighed the North and the arguments of abolitionists and everything else, and indentured servanthood, and we opened it up, and they had to spent one day talking about it, and then they had to go and take that conversation that night and produce how they would have handled, if they were in leadership, the different things that were out there, and turn that in paper format. And they were ready for the process, not the
end state.
Not the end state.
See, that's one of the difficult pieces with this why, mm-hmm. is we like to know what the right answer is. And because we are in a conservative Baptist kind of environment, we know the right answer about everything. Just ask us. We'll tell you the right translation, the right mode of baptism, the right clothing. We know the right thing about everything, the right eschatology. We know the right church government. I mean, we're right on everything. And we know we are. So when you come over here and you go to this why part, recognize that if you have 21 students, you've got 21 different answers, and all of them could be correct.
That's right.
Now, I know one of the teachers and pastors has two children. And one of them is just bent on knowing what the right answer is. And this kind of stuff drives that student crazy. Mm-hmm. Crazy. Because there isn't a right answer. Here's one for science. Why is evolution a valid alternative to creationism? Now listen to the question. Why is evolution a valid alternative to creationism? Now the very question seems to be authenticating evolution. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it? So right away, how many of your students would not understand that they can answer that question by saying it is not a valid, and they explain why? Or would you also accept the idea that it is a valid alternative? You were getting ready to say something, Megan.
Yeah. One of the things they did in 7th and 8th grade with our intro to evolution and creation kind of ideas, instead of taking the textbooks and say this is what they say, this is why it's wrong, so on and so forth, we just divided all the topics to every student. So each student had a topic. They had looking, this person had looking at the age of the earth. This person had talking about stem cell research, or just looking at different ideas that help support evolution and carbon dating and that kind of stuff. And they had to tell me, first of all, what's the evolutionist belief? Because we're bad at just telling them, this is one thing that they say and this is wrong and this is what we believe. So instead, their first job was to go look at, what do these people believe? What do they think? Why do they think it's right? What's valid out of the science that they did? And then they had to present what we believe a creationist and put it together. Is anything that they believe valid? Where are the faults? Where are this and that? And present it and talk to it to the class so they teach it and then we discuss it.
Right. Please recognize in this room that Noah did not have all the millions of animals that we have on that ark. So there had to be some evolution going on.
That goes back to starting right with the terminology. Micro versus macro evolution. And do they understand the difference between those? And then building off that foundation, even going to the four categories of different things. Young earth versus old earth. You could have Christians on either side of that division.
Sure you can.
Even.
See, we want to have a culture in our school, a critical thinking culture in our school,
where I could answer evolution is a valid alternative to creationism and get a correct answer. Because at some point, hey, please understand, at some point, we have to allow them to begin thinking on their own. We cannot say, we cannot create a culture that the only right answer is this. They have to determine for themselves whether they believe in creationism or not. They have to. What should make us distinct from the public school is that we present creationism as a valid understanding, a valid perspective. This is the alternative, and then you choose which one you believe to be true. We don't want a culture to where anyone who says this is a valid alternative is an F because they didn't get the right answer.
Well, I was going to say, we want to prepare them to be shot down as well when they get out into the real world because people will not agree with biblical viewpoints. I'm thinking specifically of that case where that young man wrote that article of arguing against gay marriage in that public school. And he immediately got in trouble. And it was an opposing viewpoint.
Right, and we criticized that from our side, but would we allow the reverse to happen in our school?
And we should be able to teach them that when they leave, they will be criticized. And not to get discouraged, but to keep on trucking on, to keep on, if that is what you believe and it is biblical, then you stick to it.
Why is it okay for God to be jealous, but I can't be jealous? Mm-hmm. Why is it okay for God to seek glory, but I can't seek glory? I don't understand that. That's a critical thinking question, isn't it? Isn't that a reasonable thing to battle through? Do you want the first time they think about that when they're pursuing their master's degree? Because they've had a sheltered education? Or are we going to be the ones that bring in a culture of it is okay to ask that question? It's okay to ask that question. It is okay to grapple with that. What do you think? Where would you want to go to school if you could have to do it all over again? Would you want to go to school where they can teach you to think? Or what kind of balance would you want?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you want to be able to think. I mean, thinking is all I do. I mean, criticize everything. You know, I mean, that's, and if you don't do that, then you could easily fall into something blindly that may not be true.
Right. Independent Fundamental Baptist churches are often being accused of having a cultic environment. It's occurring right now in the news with the big one up in Indiana. Cultic environment. We don't want our graduates talking about the cultic environment at Brainerd Baptist Academy. We want them talking about the fact that I was taught this, I was taught this, I was taught why we believe this, and I was allowed to think. That's a compliment to an academy. That's a compliment. That is not we're failing as an academy. It goes all the way back to what Joey said. Either we trust in the sovereignty of God or we don't. You as parents, you're going to do everything you can with your firstborn, and in the end, you turn them over to God. That's what we do. All right, let me just give you a couple ideas and we'll be done. Three ways that I think you can incorporate this in a very practical way. Number one, all teachers, and I don't know about first grade, second grade, but somewhere there's a transition, third, fourth, somewhere around there, you could have a daily or weekly question. You could have a daily or weekly question. So this would be on your board. This would be this is the question we're thinking about for the week, for example, a weekly question. This would be a critical thinking question. You could write it on like a piece of poster or something. You know, you could bring it into class and start the class. This is our critical thinking question and dedicate 5 minutes each day in the lower grades and culminate with 25 minutes on Friday or something like that. That would be your weekly thing. Number two, we talked about it already, but I want you to look at your lesson plans and I want you to look at your testing. And I want you to look at every test, quiz, significant test, and ask yourself, are critical thinking questions integrated into this lesson or into this test already? And then how can I integrate them? Then question number three, or the third idea is, give them critical thinking assignments. Give them critical thinking assignments. In critical thinking assignments, I'm not going to get graded on spelling and grammar and those things. I'm going to be graded on one thing. Did I think through this? I'm not graded on whether I got the right answer, because there is no right answer. I'm not graded on I'm graded on have I presented a coherent, logical, thought through thing. How different would America be if we had not won World War II? Now describe it. How different would America? That's going to cause the student to think. They're going to have to think through. Okay, and then you can ask them probing questions. Well, what language do you think we'd be speaking? What type of government do you think we'd be speaking? How much of the European culture would have transitioned over? See how you can go. But you're asking those questions to get their mind thinking so that they begin to formulate sentences and can put it in some kind of coherency. And all you're grading for at that point is just to see, are they thinking through? No, scale of 1 to 10, and 10 is a great thought through, and 9 is less, and that's it. You're not ripping apart grammar or any of those things. You're just giving them a critical thinking question. I saw it at the hand, I thought. No? Joey?
When I was at BCC, I went to public school, so I had absolutely no grammar. So I took a political science class at the beginning of my sophomore year, and I failed the paper. And the professor put, great ideas, horrible formatting, horrible grammar. And I remember taking English Lit classes and getting back my English Lit paper because I had not formatted it exactly the way that it was supposed to be formatted. And so when I left BCC, I could really format a research paper. But it seemed like so there were certain professors, some more than others, but the general idea was if you didn't do it exactly the way we said to do it, then everything else, you know, isn't valid. And that was extremely frustrating to get back. Well, this is not a bad idea, but your grammar is not great. Well, I wasn't talking grammar.
And of course, Joey, what we want is we want to integrate the two concepts together. Yes. You know, so if I was that, we'd have two grades. And this is your grade for content, your grade for thinking, this is your grade for grammar. You got an A for thinking, F there, here's a C. If you'd like to get an A paper, then you're going to have to learn how to do this right here. But you're definitely on the thinking process above, and we want to reward that.
That's where rubrics come in handy.
Yep, and we talked about those last year. Yeah. And then finally, we mentioned it earlier, but please begin to incorporate book reviews instead of book reports. Small things. Small things. Got to learn the book report. And then one sentence or one paragraph or one thing. Yeah, something as simple as they have to ask the question, what bias did the author bring to the book? They're a Southerner. Well, that's going to bring a bias. It's going to bring a bias. They're a Southerner. You know, you just pick whatever you want. They're an Orthodox Jew. There's a whole bias right there. It's coming through. They're a right-wing KJV-only independent bat. There's another bias. They're a Presbyterian. It's another bias. You can pick. They're a socialist. Another bias. If they don't begin to look at that and begin to critique it, they're going to be so unprepared for the world. More so than before. And the reason I say that is, where are they getting information from? The internet. That's their number one source of information. And there's no filter on the internet. You don't have to get published. Mm-hmm. You used to be able to have to get published, and getting published lent a degree of credibility because everyone couldn't get published. I just start my own blog. I just upload it to Wikipedia. I just put it on myself. So if we're not teaching our students how to critically think, who is the author? What gives him credentials to write about this thing? What biases does he bring into his reporting? Does anyone else validate him? I was arguing with a student, a graduate, and we were going back and forth in email traffic back and forth.
And I said, could you please name one Orthodox theologian who agrees with you? You know? Are you the only one that has this off-wall? If not, you know, bring something, lend some credibility. Well, that's what I'm talking about. Does that make sense? I'm talking about teaching that. All right, closing questions. I don't want anyone to have any misunderstandings about what we're suggesting when we work hard on creating a culture of critical thinking. James.
It is always a time and a place, too. I mean, that's the tension that we talk about in the midst of, you know, I'm teaching the Bible lesson. I want you to ask a question. I don't want you to, I don't know how to.
Use it as a platform?
Yeah, I don't need you to get on a soapbox and tell me why your church doesn't think what I think. Mm-hmm. At the end, let's discuss that.
Yeah, or we will dedicate Friday to discussing that. You know? I want to deal with that. I want to deal with the difference between why do Baptists baptized by immersion and Presbyterians don't. And since we're on this text, let's talk about that on Friday, and we'll talk about on, and then that gives you some time to prepare properly so that you make sure, because we're not here to bash. Mm-hmm. We're not here to bash. Yeah. It's not a matter of tradition for us. We are firmly convinced that this is what the Word of God teaches from this area right here. But this is why they don't incorporate that, and they do have something to say. People get so uncomfortable with me when I say from the pulpit that I understand why Free Will Baptists believe what they believe about losing their salvation. That makes people so uncomfortable. So what do you mean? Well, evidently you're not looking at the same warning passages that I'm looking up in the book of Hebrews, because when I see them, they scare me too. Mm-hmm. So we're here to say there has some validity there. And if it wasn't for this, then I'd go that direction. And this is the only reason I'm over here, and I respect that. Think about the way that culture brings maturation into our school.
I think at the same time we have to be careful how we, like if there is a time and a place like there is in the classroom, how we tell the student that it's not the time, because I had a professor in college who wanted us to put our critical thinking into a paper, but as soon as I put my critical thinking into a paper, he formed a bias because the author of the book was actually his friend and failed me on the paper because I actually used critical thinking. But at the same time, I was thinking in my head, man, I'm not going to use critical thinking anymore because all it's going to do is get me in trouble. But later on, I had another professor who rewoke that up in me, because every single paper that we wrote, which was like 12 to 15 papers, you got stuck in front of the class and it was open for questions. Mm-hmm. Anybody could ask them. You had to be able to back with Bible, Scripture, what you believe and why. And so it's very easy to shut off a student on critical thinking if we don't pay attention to how we respond to the questions.
Brian?
I think it's important that with the critical thinking we teach that respect of questioning. Like you had mentioned with the student that you were almost ready to assign demerits because of the way it was. We make sure we teach it's okay to ask. Just make sure.
And see, that's now we're working on character development there.
Right.
You know, and that's part of maturation. And that would that character development trait would never come up if we don't create that environment.
Exactly.
My question was, I struggle with trying to get the kids to be more creative. Like with your book, we have to come up with a theme, and it feels like I'm the one coming up with the ideas, and they're just sitting there, you know, glass-eyed, not even thinking, because when I've got the two or three people coming up with ideas, I can connect them to make a better theme, and yet they're not seeing this. How do you get them to think creatively is my biggest struggle.
Yeah, well, I will tell you that this is my little rookie assessment, and it's only a six-year assessment, so there's a lot more experience in this room. But what I've seen so far in my little 6 years is that if this is third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, somewhere along here, and this is 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, somewhere along this transition, it stops being cool to learn and be the answerer and to be the creative one and to enjoy Bible. And it's like somewhere along here, because this is awesome and they're into it, and then there still are a little bit, and then somewhere around here, peer pressure begins to take over, and how I look in front of my peers becomes more important than whether I have the approval of the teacher or the adult.
Right about age 13.
Yeah. So how do you draw them out of that? That's my question. How do you draw them out? How do you get them interacting?
Right. Okay, so this is my response. When you get the answer, you write a book, and you publish it, and you will be wealthy. Because nobody knows. I mean, nobody knows. I mean, we have to create a culture where it's cool to know the Bible. Where it's cool to think about theological things. To where the cool kids think about theological things, that the cool kids have debates about socialism versus free market, where the cool kids talk about the problems with the Republican Party and the problems with the Democratic Party, and where and all I'm suggesting is that the more we do it here, hopefully there'll be some spillover. When I hear I was doing fifth grade and sixth grade, the more we do it in junior high, hopefully there'll be some more spillover. That's all. Because it seems to be, if this is my graphing, and then we pick up college, and then it becomes cool again, somewhere around like senior year in college and master's degree. Yeah. But there's this window of time here of high school and freshman year in college where it's not cool. And I don't have any answer to that.
Well, it goes into developmental psychology. Erickson stated that between the ages of 13 and 21... peer relationship is the primary goal for that age group, because it's at that point that they're beginning to challenge where they fit in the world. And at 21, they've identified who they want to be. So they now, it's okay for me to be an academic. I want to be an academic. But between that age group, they're not sure, and they don't want to appear different than anyone else. Mm-hmm. So one of the keys I found in the classroom for what you're talking about is I get the two or three athletes that are looked up to throughout our school and everything else, and I go to them and I petition them specifically, will you have a discussion conversation with me in front of class? This is the question I'm asking tomorrow. These are some of the objectives I want to do. And I'll ask them 4 or 5 days in advance for them to prepare their answers so that they kick it off. And because they're the cool kids that the kids are looking up to, it starts to draw the other kids in, and it developed over the year until I eventually had the whole class.
And that's why I keep using the word culture.
Mm-hmm. But you have to find those key leaders that...
Sure, the leaders
that
determine
that
the culture.
...that are strong enough to set the environment.
Yeah.
And it can't be the teacher setting it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's what's so enjoyable about 5th grade, 6th grade, 7th grade, mm-hmm. and then somehow... it transitions and it
right.
becomes very difficult.
Right.
Anyone else?
I just got a word of personal testimony. I hope you don't mind. But my first year of teaching was my first year teaching Austin. And one of the things that I think made me the strongest teacher, I mean, just
my
looking
son.
Back.
I see where this is going.
Pastor would come to me after every assignment, any quiz, and he would say, why? Why are we learning this? Why are you teaching this? Because I have to tell Austin something, and he doesn't connect the dots. He's not either. He doesn't understand why you're teaching it in class, or he doesn't care. But I have to tell him something, and it made me take every super analyze everything I did, so that now, I mean, someone could pull up, you know, in front of my class, they could walk in and go, why are you teaching this? You know, what's the purpose of this paper? And I could just say it. Because I don't do anything in the class that I don't have an answer for. And I think that's what we also want to incorporate in our students. Why am I doing this? Why do I have this Christian practice? And they just have the answer right there because they know they've thought it through. They've analyzed it.
Yeah, going all the way back to our text. Give an answer for the hope that lies within you.
I noticed something I was saved at 13. And people that were in my circles... they were gung-ho about certain things and critical of people who didn't walk the line and wear the and comb their hair and all that. Mm-hmm. But then they would get their family get upset, leave the church, and next week you'd see them in the mall wearing the things they were criticizing other people about. And I felt like that maybe because I had seen this side and I chose to follow Christ, it was easier for me to stand by my beliefs because I'd seen both sides and I had chosen, whereas some of them had just followed suit and matched everybody else, but then when their family left, they went and did whatever.
And Deb, what we're trying to figure out is those of us that have been bringing our children to church from birth, how do we keep a scenario whereby they have to go live like the devil for a couple of years in order to come back? We don't want that.
No.
We don't want that. You know, we don't want them to have to go through that, either before they get saved or some period in the middle, and then they're really questioning, was I saved after that, and did I just live like the devil when I was saved, or is this a, you know, sanctifying moment, or a second conversion, or, you know, all that nonsense. We want them to be able to experience some of that without the sin, which is thinking through it.
Charles Spurgeon's, his whole family were preachers. His dad was a preacher. Grandfather was a preacher. He didn't get converted until he was 15 years of age. And when he was 14, he decided that if I ever get converted, I'm going to be a Baptist because their views are unassailable. And yet, he went for this whole time period of his life never being converted, but he never lived a life of sin. And so, as I was doing a paper on how did Spurgeon keep from that? Because he was living in England when modernism was prevalent, and it would have been very easy for him to go all down these different paths, and it had to be the patience of his mother and father in allowing him to find it on his own and not try to convince him that he was converted when he wasn't converted. And it's just an amazing thing. Whereas you had someone like C.S. Lewis, who was raised kind of a Puritan, became an atheist, and came back to Christianity. The reason he left Christianity is because they always dismiss the other person's argument as just stupid. Well, that's not true, so it can't, you know, that's not what we believe, so it can't be right. And then when he started asking questions, he realized, well, they have some valid points. Like, why do they have to be wrong? No one had ever dealt with that. And he had to go through a stage of his life that he probably would not have gone through if people had been more willing to answer questions and be patient with him.
Okay. Kevin, you'll close this off.
Just a question about something you said back about Noah's Ark. What did you mean by there had to be some evolution? I don't understand what you were saying there.
Well, depending on how, Kevin, I mean in the sense of how you understand evolution.
Okay.
In the sense, I mean, things are evolving now. So in that, if you have an evolution idea that's the only cause, or cause is not the right word I want to say, is that the transition of life forms, you know, the single cell, multi-cell, and all that, or what about within a breed of animals, for example, dogs, the multiplicity of dogs that we have.
The gene pool.
Yeah, it's a big gene pool, right. Yeah, and that, which is why Jackie right away went to macro versus micro, and the distinction between the two. I mean, we should not tell students that there is no evolution. That is just not a fair statement to make. Because you can still see that today. Not in the sense that the large scale, but it is happening. Animals are going away that didn't exist. And there are changes that are occurring in species based on climates and environments and things like that.
Right, but it's not a new species. It's just a variation of what was there. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's a fair statement.
Okay.
Right. So we just want to be able to teach them that, oh, there is no evolution. Well, when they say something like that, they look stupid. Where'd you go to school? Oh, okay. As opposed to being able to unpack what is reasonable, what do we see in science, what isn't contrary to the Word of God, and then what is contrary to the Word of God. Okay, anyone else? All right, we are dismissed.